This is a very special edition of Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle. Today we celebrate the 500th edition of this program with WBGO's legendary announcer Gary Walker as my guest. Gary actually was the first voice ever heard on Sports Jam. Back in 2008, Gary provided the introduction to the Sports Jam podcast, and we spent 27 plus years together now on WBGO. And it's my pleasure to welcome the iconic voice of mornings at WBGO and the host of Daybreak, Gary Walker, to this milestone episode. Gary, great to have you on the show.
Hey, it's great to be here, Doug. Now, it's $49.95, right, to be on your show?
There is no charge to be a guest on Sports.
It's free?
It is free.
Really?
Yep, so you don't have to worry about...
I'm going to hang out for a while then.
Sports has really been a part of your life, Gary. You and I have always texted each other when we're off the air about the NFL games and whatnot, especially when my Pittsburgh Steelers are battling your Cleveland Browns. And we've learned through the years on this program that sports and music are ultimate connectors. And many of the guests have talked about it. Baseball Hall of Famer, New York Giants, and Newark Eagles star Monty Irvin joined saxophone giant Jimmy Heath on the program to talk about how sports figures and musicians would hang out together all the time. Gary, the first person you interviewed in the WBGO studio, I believe, was the late, great guitarist Vic Juris, who was a big boxing fan and was one of the guests on Sports Jam. Is that correct?
That is correct, Doug. He was one of the very first people, in fact. He and I became pretty good friends. He even gave my brother Greg a couple of guitar lessons. This is way back in the early 80s. You know, we went down to Fat Tuesdays. Remember Fat Tuesdays?
Yeah.
We went down there to see Vic Juris, and the two of them hit it off. And he ended up giving Greg a couple of guitar lessons, too. He's a major cat, man.
What a great guy Vic was. We certainly miss him. Also, you suggested that I talk with the great pianist Monty Alexander for Sports Jam. He's been on the show twice talking about his love of boxing. They were both amazing guests. How did you look at the synergy, and how do you feel about the synergy between sports and music?
Well, you know, it's an obvious connection, you know, because when you get in a group setting with jazz musicians, you know, there's a camaraderie. When you get out on the ball diamond with baseball players, you know, there's nine cats that are trying to work together. When you're doing football, it's 11 cats, right? Yeah. And when you've been convicted of something, it's 12 people that come together and come up with your sentence. But, you know, you talked to recently, Lee Mergner spoke with Sonny Rollins, and they talked mostly about sports. Sonny, a huge Mets fan. And loved his baseball team. There is an obvious connection there. The teamwork, the camaraderie, coming together, coming up with different plays. You know, in the jazz setting, it's a communal kind of thing. You know, Wynton Marsalis has said many times, he's played around the world with different musicians. He said, I've been on a stage, and none of us spoke the same language except the language of music. We came together over that.
Absolutely. Knicks legend Earl the Pearl Monroe was a guest on this show and talked about his friendship with Miles Davis, and Yankees great Bernie Williams, a terrific guitarist, just loved coming into the WBGO studios for a Sports Jam episode where he opened up talking about his music. I didn't even know it was the same Bernie Williams, because he was so quiet when he was with the Yankees. But then when you talked about his music and writing a song for his daughter, it was just like opening up a whole new window into the great career of Bernie Williams. Now, Gary, you moved around a lot as a kid. You were born in Huntington, West Virginia. You moved to Detroit when you were just 2 years old, and then to Salem, Ohio when you were five. Was it your dad that got you into sports?
It was indeed my father that got me into sports. We would play catch in the front yard or the backyard. Later on, he taught me how to play tennis. I didn't really gravitate toward it too well, like my dad did. He was outstanding. And then we would play golf. And we would go out, you know, it'd be a typical summer evening at the dinner table. And he'd say, you want to go hit some balls? Yeah, sure. And so we'd go out to the country club where my parents belonged, and we'd, you know, hit balls. And in those days, you had to shag your own balls at the end. and until the sun went down. I'm out there in the dark, you know, that thing that picks up the golf balls. And those are some of the early recollections of doing sports with my dad.
Who was better, your dad or you at golf?
Oh, my father, without a doubt, my father. And he was an outstanding badminton player and also played tennis with the legendary Jack Purcell. Some of you may have worn Purcell tennis shoes, you know, with a little blue stripe around the toe. Yeah, my dad actually played tennis and badminton, I believe both.
At the age of 89, Spike, my dad, was still a better golfer than I will ever be. I mean, he used to carry, by the end of his golfing days, all woods in his bag, except for the putter.
Is that right?
He would play off the fairways with woods. I can't, I could never match the way he could play golf. And my brother Don and I, we didn't pick up that trait of being a golfer. I could hit a good shot off the tee every now and then, but that's
Yeah.
about it.
How many holes did you and your dad play?
We would play 18.
My father and I too. One weekend though, we played 36 holes of golf.
Oh my goodness.
And we walked.
Oh yeah,
We
those days,
walked
right? You would walk.
and we both had leather bags.
Wow. And you caddied for a while too.
I did caddy for a while. It was a great way to make some extra dollars when I was 13, 14 years old. I would caddy, and it was a lot of fun. And when I lived in Fort Worth, Texas, later on, we would sneak across the Trinity River. Many people who follow golf know about the legendary Colonial Open at the Colonial Golf Course Golf Club there in Fort Worth, Texas, where the trophy room is all dedicated to Ben Hogan, who once upon a time was the pro at the club. And we would sneak across the Trinity River and walk up on the hill and watch people playing golf until the people, you know, the I don't know what you call them, hall monitors, I guess we used to call them at school, but they would walk through the crowd and they'd see us without our badges, and they would escort us to the front gate. And we would walk back around and cross over the Trinity River again and come back up and watch some of the greats of golf. Saw Arnold Palmer, Dr. Carey Middlecoff, I remember, and so many others I got to see as a kid.
You and I have one thing in common when it comes to the
That would be
physic.
our weight.
Well, that's true, but it didn't start off that way when you and I met each other. We weren't as big as we are now. And
That's true.
you might even remember when Fran Ashby, she physically made a Steelers jersey for me my third week on the air. She came into WBGO, I was a seamstress in Newark, and she handed me this beautiful shirt that she
You
had
made
made.
it out of curtain material,
That's correct.
I remember. And the shirt was a one of a kind. And Doug would go to, you know, Steelers games. He would go to Pittsburgh Pirates games, and he would wear that shirt. And people would try to offer him a lot of money for it because it was indeed truly one of a kind.
Yeah, it was beautiful. You could see it on the website, especially in the Jim Brown episode. You'll see that I'm wearing it when I'm pointing to Jim Brown's plaque at Brown Stadium. But when we talk about the early days and playing, when I played high school basketball at Franklin Regional, it was my junior year, and I didn't get a lot of playing time at that time. It didn't start to my senior year.
Excuse
And
me, let me take a sip of this red wine here.
what happened was
It's actually cranberry juice.
I was fouled at the end of the game. And
Yeah.
if I make the two free throws, we win the game. And fortunately, I made them. And the sports writer wrote Franklin's poor foul shooter, Doug, went to the line and made the two free throws. And I was so angry because I wasn't a poor free throw shooter and because I rarely played. So I cursed him out to myself. He passed away, and I took his job as the sports writer for that paper less than a year later. But I bring up free throw shooting, but because for Gary Walker, free throw shooting was his thing. And when he was 11 years old, he had a groundbreaking moment for his sports career.
I did indeed. The place, Salem, Ohio, we were living, and they had an all-city foul shooting competition, all different age groups, and they would separate the age groups. And I, of course, was in the elementary school group, but we shot at the foul line. What is that? 12 feet back, I think. And I qualified, and then I went. I had to come back the next day for the finals, and your total was 75 shots. And I made 72 out of 75 shots
As an 11-year-old.
as an 11-year-old. And the only person that beat me was a guy that was on the high school basketball team.
Incredible.
And by the way, also on that high school basketball team was a cat named Lou Slaby, who also was an outstanding football player. And those of you that are New York Giants fans, Lou Slaby went on to professional heights, and he was the guy that took Sam Huff's place as linebacker for the New York Giants.
You have seen some of the greatest players of all time. We're going to get to that in a little bit, but
Yeah.
I want to stick with basketball just for a moment. After 10th grade, you discovered girls, and that kind of took you out of sports.
Yeah, it kind of put me on the sideline there, but I was on the court with the girls.
Always a chick magnet, Gary Walker, through the
Well,
years.
I could dance, and the reason I could dance so well is when my father left the industrial complex that he was involved with, primarily in the automotive industry, he bought three drive-in restaurants. This is after my mother had passed when I was 12 years old. And Car Hops, remember Car Hops? Car Hops taught me how to dance. So if I was a chick magnet in junior high school, it was the Car Hops that I need to tip the Indians cap to.
Speaking of the Indians cap, now known as the Cleveland Guardians, of course, but when Gary would go to watch his beloved Indians, he saw some of the great players of all time.
Cleveland's Bob Feller contributed many memorable moments. One of the finest performances of a man whose career included three no-hitters and 12 one-hitters was against the Tigers. The date, October the 2nd, 1938, closing day of the season.
Let's go back to that time when you saw the then Cleveland Indians. Talk about some of the players, including Bob Feller, that you saw play for your team.
Fastball Bob Feller, I got to see. I got to see Rocky Colavito. Roger Maris spent his first year in the pros as a Cleveland Indian, and then he went on to the New York Yankees, as many people know. But also, whom I,
Manny Manoso.
Minnie Minoso. That's right, good old Minnie Minoso, and Bobby Avila, second base. Larry Doby, he was the first African American to play in that league. Spectacular. And I never thought I'd run into those cats again. But one morning, I was on the air
That's a great
at
story, anyway.
WBGO, and I was telling, one of my long drawn out stories about the Cleveland Indians. And I referenced all those great players that I had a chance to see. And I mentioned the second baseman, Bobby Vila, and I said, this cat was unbelievable. So I go back to music, and back in those days, we actually answered the phone in the control room. And so I answered the phone, and this guy said, "Yeah, is this the guy that was talking about the Cleveland Indians a couple of minutes ago?" And I said, "Well, yeah, it is." He said, "You made a mistake. And it's not Bobby Vila, it's Bobby Avila." I went, "Oh, yeah, I think you're right." I said, "So you must be a Cleveland Indians fan, huh?" And the guy paused for a second, and he goes, "Yeah, you might say so. This is Larry Doby." And Larry Doby, when after he retired, many some people know this. He lived in Montclair, New Jersey, and he was also a big fan of jazz, in addition to sports and such. And he was a listener in the morning. You never know who's listening in the morning. You just never know who's out there.
Hooray, hooray, the time has really come. Come. Cleveland got Larry Doby. Brooklyn's got Jackie Robinson.
Once again, for those who don't remember, Larry Doby did break the color barrier in the American League, like Jackie Robinson did in the National League. And he and I've had many talks with his son, because they, you know, when they dedicated Hinchliffe Stadium, Larry Doby ran track, I believe, at that stadium. And so his son, Larry Doby Jr., was there. We talked about his dad, who played for the Newark Eagles as well, not only in the major leagues. And we've had, some people talk about playing with the Newark Eagles in that time here on Sports Gym. It was very special. Also, you went to see the Detroit Tigers play a lot with your cousins in Michigan.
Oh, I tell you, man, I love the Indians, but just as much, I love the Detroit Tigers with Al Kaline and Norm Cash. Later on, the pitcher, who also was a pretty fine author, Jim Bunning, was on the mound. Some great players that were in Detroit. And I can't remember the guy that called the games, a legendary sportscaster out of the big station there in Detroit.
Renicki off the bag at first. The pitch, he swings, and there's a fly ball to left. Here comes Herndon. He's there. He's got it. The Tigers are the champions of 1984. They race on the field to Bob Hernandez. The Tigers have won the World Series. They are the champions of the world in 1984.
Legendary Tigers announcer Ernie Harwell.
Oh, man, they'd make that game come right out of the speakers at you.
Did you like to listen to games on the radio?
Oh, I loved it, Doug. Absolutely loved listening to games on the radio. Both the Cleveland Indians. And it's funny, but one of my first radio jobs was for a little station in Kent, Ohio. And one of my responsibilities was I was the production assistant for the Cleveland Indians Baseball Network, where I had to make sure that the spot breaks and everything came. This is the secondary markets around Northeast Ohio that carried the Indians ball games.
That had to be a thrill for you.
Well, no, I was just hoping the games would get over so I could play rock and roll music, because I got to play rock music afterward. And some of those games went really long. It's a wonder I wasn't relieved of my duties, because I would do creative things like, with the sound of crickets on carts. And I forgot all about this. Put them on carts, and then they'd be calling a game to be like the 12th inning, and the stands had already fanned out, and you'd hear these cricket sounds coming up ever so slightly. And then if there was a pause in the conversation, like they noticed something, I would quick pot it out. I had fun with sports.
Did you first hear sports or music on the radio?
I first heard music on the radio, Doug, and it was music when I was living in Ohio. It was music from far away, as WBZ in Boston at night, WLS in Chicago at night.
The superstations, right? They call them
superstations. And of course, the big stations in Cleveland that played rock and roll. Yeah, I remember that.
You got connected not only through broadcasting, but you were a roadie for some of the great shows of rock and roll.
I loved some of those things, and I spent, well, not a whole bunch, but I spent a brief period of my life when I was in Texas as a roadie for the legendary Johnny Winter. Mm. And I didn't last very long. I only lasted about 3 weeks. It was pretty raucous.
I think it was sports on the radio before it was music. And I had the great pleasure of having my broadcasting idol, Mike Lang, the voice of the Pittsburgh Penguins, on the show.
Didn't he host the dating game?
No. That was not
Jim. That was Jim Lang.
That was Jim Lang. And no relation. But Mike Lang, Hall of Fame announcer, known for all of his catchphrases like, you know, scratch my back with a hacksaw when the Penguins would score, and it would always be
out right side, Murphy shooting, same eight, rebound on the view. Hey! Shoots and scores! Mario Lemieux, and the Penguins lead 5-4, and you'd have to be here to believe it. Mario Lemieux has given the Penguins the lead.
As soon as you heard him go, he, you knew the Penguins would score because on radio, right? So as soon as he got into that, it was like, so to have him on the show was indeed a great pleasure. And he has passed since, and we will all miss the great Mike Lang, especially those in Pittsburgh. But for you, you got to see two of the all-time Hall of Famers at one time, at one game. Tell us about that.
My dad, when he was in college, he went to Michigan State. And it's funny because he went there on a scholarship, a debate scholarship. But he was quite an athlete, too. And he would play tennis, right? But he loved to play hockey. And all of them down the front of his legs were all these scars from, you know, getting the puck, you know, before they actually wore the padding that they should have worn all the time. But we were living in Detroit, and I was a young teenager, and my dad took me to the Olympia. Some of you Detroiters, you know about the Olympia in Detroit, where he actually walked up the stairs to get into the rink. And there I saw my first hockey game, and it was the Detroit Red Wings against the Chicago Blackhawks. So you had, you know, this incredible workout between Gordie Howe and Bobby Hull. And it was that night that Bobby Hull actually got a hat trick, which is three goals in one game. And everybody started throwing hats and stuff out on the ice. And I said to my dad, I said, what the hell's going on here? And he goes, son, that's a hat trick. That's something you don't see very often. And Bobby Hull just scored his third goal. And that's what they do. They throw things out on the ice. I'll never forget that, man. The old Olympia. I don't believe it's even there anymore.
Hellman after it. Covered by Moon. Played out to Bobby Hull. He's got a breakaway. Nobody near him. He's going in alone. Right in that goal. He sees the score. Now let's look at the replay of that goal. Bobby Hull going all the way. At center ice on a breakaway.
Chicago goal scored by Hull. Assisted by Mones and Vasco. The time, 14 minutes, 59 seconds.
14:59. Howl from Vasco, 2-1, Chicago.
That reminds me of the first, I think it was the first hockey game I ever took my daughter Casey to. And the goalies, I mean, I tried to make her a Penguins fan, obviously. that's a funny part of the story, but the goalies for that game, it was in New Jersey. So it was the Devils, Martin Brodeur, Hall of Fame goalie, maybe the best goalie of all time. And Patrick Waugh was goaling for the Colorado Avalanche. So she got to see these two great goalies, and she eventually became a goalie in lacrosse. But she admitted to me years later, she wore a patch on her eye to strengthen her one eye at the time. And she goes, Dad, I couldn't see during that game, right? So that's her big memory. And she did turn around to me at one point. She said, Dad, we're with all Devils fans here. Why are you wearing your Penguins jersey? So
allegiance.
Yeah, I told her, you know, you can start rooting for the teams that you want to. For you, you got to share a lot of different things with your son, Nate. Even motocross. Nate had really took up to motocross, didn't he?
Oh, man, I'll tell you. You know, when my wife and I split up, she went back to Ohio. And when she remarried, she married this great guy, Denny. And he was an organic farmer. So they had a good amount of land. And so, and he was also a cyclist, you know, a motocross cyclist. And he taught Nate how to ride. And on the land, he actually built like a 2-mile course that Nate could practice on, you know, going down through ravines and up and through streams and stuff. Nate got to be so good at that he actually placed a couple of times in races, and he wanted to know about the machines that he was sitting on, and he learned, and still to this day, he can do it better than me for sure and anybody else around him. He can take apart a motorcycle piece by piece, lay it all out on the ground, and put it all back together.
Oh, my goodness, that's a skill. You used to ride motorcycles.
I had a motorcycle once, and it was a wonderful experience until I was coming home from work one night and a dog ran out on the road. I had a nice Triumph, nice bike, and I flew up over the handles and my shin caught the handlebar and like just snapped my shin like a matchstick. I've never been in so much pain in my life. And I never got on motorcycles after that. I did get on a little Honda one time with Nate when we were out at the farm, and he wanted to show me his latest bike, a Kawasaki, I think it was. And he had this little Honda, you know. So I sat on that.
You know, those who've been listening to Gary through the years know that we would talk about our kids, Casey and Nate, quite a bit as we would go through. And Nate actually interned in the WBGO news department for me, and he was terrific. He had such a mature voice as a teenager that I would have people come in and say, who was that person that he had on the air? And I said, that's
including
Nate.
His own father. One right. day he called me into the production room. He goes, Nate, show your dad what you're working on. And so he pushes a button and he plays this tape. And I went, wow, that's really good. Nate, who's that voice? Did you write that?
Yeah.
Well, who's that voice? He goes,
that's me.
Great
His own
voice.
Father didn't even recognize him.
And those who have been around Nate know that he has a wonderful sense of humor like his dad.
He is the absolute funniest person on this planet to me. Never run into anybody quicker or funnier than he is. And impressions, oh my goodness. Everybody from Benny King that he sees on those old television commercials, right? To Meatwad, one of those cartoon characters that you used to see late at night, and so many other things. He's just a genuinely funny young man who's now 35 years old.
It's funny that you mentioned, because my son-in-law Joe now is also great at impressions. His Jim Carrey as the Grinch is just something that everyone needs to see at some point. Let's get back to some of the legends that you have seen play in person before they even became huge stars in the pros.
Thurman is there to put it in.
You see a guy like Nate Thurman hustle, and you know what professional sports is all about.
Nate Thurman would have to be recognized as one of the best individual defensive players one-on-one in the center position that's ever played the game.
Nate Thurman, one of the great shot blockers we've had in the NBA.
Followed by Thurman. He's done that a few times in his career.
This guy was great. He was fearless. He had tremendous instincts.
You saw 1985 Basketball Hall of Fame inductee Nate Thurman play high school basketball at Akron Central alongside Gus Johnson. What do you remember about Nate Thurman?
This was much earlier than 1985, but
he was in the Hall of Fame inducted in 85.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you're right. No, I saw him in high school. Akron Central, I believe, is the school that he played for, and I don't even remember Gus Johnson that much until later on. But Nate Thurman, he was so damn tall, even in high school. It was unbelievable. And later, I would have a chance to see Nate Thurman again in 1976 when Bill Fitch, who was the coach of the Cleveland Cavaliers at the time, took the Cleveland Cavaliers to the quarterfinals, and a 41-year-old Nate Thurman was a part of that team. Austin Carr, you remember Austin Carr?
Oh,
he was the playmaker on that team.
One of the really all-time greats at Notre Dame, Austin Carr.
Yes, indeedy.
Not only did you see Nate Thurman, but you saw the great Paul Warfield, the superstar wide receiver for the Browns and Dolphins, who was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1985.
He played for a high school, Warren Harding, and they had played Salem, right? And I used to go to the Salem games where Lou Slaby was a part of the – he was actually the fullback. You know, later on, as I mentioned earlier, he would be the a linebacker for the New York Giants. But then he was a fullback for the Salem Quakers, and they played the Warren Harding team, and Paul Warfield was a wide receiver for that team. I also got to see him play basketball as well. He was an exceptional athlete, period. He could do just about anything. I believe he also did track. I want to say either broad jump or high jump, but just an exceptional athlete.
So, you know, one of the questions I always like to ask my guest, if you could go back in time, right, and you could see a specific sporting event, you could either take Nate or who, you know, or Cheryl, whoever you would like to take, what game would you go back to see and why? It can be any sport.
You know, when I was a little tiny kid in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, outside of Detroit, every year my in-laws, uncles and aunts and stuff, would come from Tecumseh in southern Michigan, and they would come to the house. And my father always got tickets to the Thanksgiving Day game, which was an annual tradition. It was between the Detroit Lions and the Green Bay Packers.
Mm.
And my dad had tickets for all the adults. I, however, had to stay home with the aunts while they made Thanksgiving dinner. And so, although I never got to attend one of those legendary Thanksgiving Day games, oh God, the quarterback, Bobby Lane. was the quarterback for the Lions at the time. Les Bingham was a lineman, weighed almost 400 pounds, later became a coach, I believe. This is pre-Joe Schmidt days.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, I wish I could have gone with my uncles and my dad to see one of those Thanksgiving Day games. Because they would come home, and whether the Lions won or not, they were all big Lions fans, and whether the Lions won or not, all they could talk about is how great the game was, regardless of the outcome.
My papap, by the way, that's what my grandson Liam will now call me papap, because my dad was papap, and for, you know, his grandchildren. But my papap, my dad's father, my grandfather, he was a huge Detroit Lion fans too. And on Thanksgiving, we couldn't wait. He would come up, and, you know, he died when I was fairly young, but I remember him coming up and waiting for the game to start on Thanksgiving, because the Lions to this day still play on Thanksgiving. And that was a special moment for me. You and I have these connections with our family and our fathers. They introduced us to the world of sports, and that's how we got involved in it. I just thought about, if I asked myself that question, I had never thought about what game would I go back to. And I guess it probably would be 2 years before I was born. In 1960, Bill Mazeroski hits the game-winning home run against the New York Yankees in the 1960 World Series. Now, why would that have special significance other than the Pirates winning the World Series? I got to play semi-pro baseball with his son, Darren, who was our second baseman, and Darren was the nicest kid. He used to get picked on by players from the other team saying, hey, your dad couldn't hit, you know, and you hit just like him. And Darren would never say anything negative about anyone. And he became a scout for the Pirates eventually. Wow. And so Darren was a terrific player, could turn the double play just like his dad. And Bill Mazeroski is now in the Hall of Fame because of his defensive play. So,
Theo, and we have a connection there too, because, you know, every morning I do show prep, just for my own enjoyment. And I noticed recently that Big Clue was the anniversary of his birth. And some people in Cincinnati know the name Ted Klazuski. And later on, they would know that name in Pittsburgh, because he went from Cincinnati to Pittsburgh. And the cat had undoubtedly the biggest arms of anyone. He had arms as big as my leg.
Pazuski rests that bat on the shoulder as Brewer looks in to get the sign from Yogi Berra. Pazuski sends a fly ball near the left field line. Williams giving it a run. It lands in the left field corner, goes up against the bullpen fence in deep left field. Pazuski goes in a second standing up. But the outfield pulled around for Pazuski. He hits at the opposite field, a long fly ball inside the left field line, rolled into the left field corner up against that bullpen enclosure for a two-bagger.
You remember Clue?
Yeah. Great player.
Oh, my God.
We have seen some legends as Gary has his Indians hat. And, of course, behind me is the great Roberto Clemente's number 21. I saw him in the 1971 World Series. I'm paying homage today to Manny Sanguin, number 35, who just was inducted into the Pirates Hall of Fame last year. We were there. Rose and I went to see that game. Mario Lemieux, I think, is the greatest player that ever put on skates, number 66. And Donnie Schell, to the other side here with the white jersey. That's his Pro Bowl jersey. Donnie Schell was a guest here on Sports Gen. Gary, we only have a couple of minutes here.
And if you look behind me, you will see a drawing, a lithograph done by Miles Davis, of course, founder of the legendary Davis Cup tennis.
No.
I might have to check that.
Wow, that is a nice one, too, though.
That is a Miles Davis lithograph.
Yeah, I love it. Gary has a lot of wonderful memorabilia. We both share that. He has music more than, and I have the sports. But I have to thank you because it was back all those years ago that when I came into the studio and met you for the first time, as I was leaving the room, you said, "I hope to see you again." Little did you know you would be saddled with my presence for 27 plus years.
Well, I'll tell you something. You know, if every saddle was that comfortable, I don't think the Cowboys would ever get off the horses. It's been a pleasure, my friend. It's been a pleasure. And a continued success with the award-winning Sports Jam with Doug Doyle. I'm Gary Walker, and it has been a true pleasure to be here with him today.
Thanks so much, Gary. The 500th episode, who better to join me than the iconic Gary Walker? We'll see you next time. Sports Jam is a WBGO Studios production. You can hear all the past shows with the likes of the late Jim Brown, Mia Hamm, Mike Tyson, the late Ann Donovan, and 9-time Emmy Award-winning bassist and Philadelphia sports fan Christian McBride at WBGO.org/SportsJam or WBGO.org/studios. You can also find Sports Jam with Doug Doyle on the NPR list of podcasts. 500 shows and a lot more to go. I'll see you at the game.